This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Punk rock has a rich history in Indiana, and today we're not just talking about it, but hearing from the musicians that lived it. And one of those musicians not only worked the scene, but is teaching a unique course about the history of punk rock. With us now is Paul Maher, an adjunct lecturer in Indiana University's Jacobs School of Music, as well as a producer, engineer, and lead singer of the Zero Boys. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Miriam.
Paul, when I think of punk rock, I imagine Mohawks, Doc Martens, leather jackets, maybe some tattoos. But I did take some time to go and listen to some music ahead of this show. And I realized, wait a minute, I actually know this music. And so it's funny because I had no idea what punk rock was or the definition. But can you tell us what the definition of punk or punk rock is?
Oh, my goodness. I'm not sure I really know the exact definition myself. But the way I approach the course is it kind of takes two streams. You know, one that starts with the kind of the philosophy. It starts with Diogenes, the Greek philosopher, and who was a cynic and kind of pushed against the system, didn't really recognize the political system. So there's that. And then, you know, the rock part, which really just kind of comes out of, you know, emphatic, aggressive, youthful music. And, you know, the term happens for the first time in the early 70s. Somebody in Cream magazine calls ? And the Mysterians punk rock. Most people would consider them to be, you know, a garage rock band. So this energy that is punk rock has been around, you know, from the beginning of time. And it doesn't really, I don't think it has an agenda, but it is a form of expression.
Mm-hmm. And how has the genre evolved over the decades? Has it become more commercial?
Well, it definitely has become more commercial. I think that, you know, the look of 70s punk rockers has been co-opted by boy bands. You know, and there's been some very, very successful, very popular punk rock bands that we call punk rock, kind of like Green Day, but all of that feels very formulaic to me. I think that there has to be some element of originality and experimentation along with the aggressiveness. And so when you listen to modern pop music, whether it's, you know, pop punk or straight pop music or even pop R&B music or pop country music, it's all blending into one thing. And it's all quite boring when it comes to like the melodic choices. And so,
yeah, well, I'm curious about how punk seems to have been sort of stereotyped as a mostly white male genre. From my understanding and the limited research that I did, punk made room for women when rock and other scenes kind of pushed them out. Why don't we hear about that as much?
Well, you hear about it in my class, for sure. And that's one thing that I am quite proud of. In the punk rock scene, it's like punk rock didn't make room for women. Women took their space. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and no one could tell them otherwise. And that is the punk attitude. Mm-hmm. But Viv Albertine, I watched an interview with her recently, and she talks about seeing the Sex Pistols for the first time, kind of growing up and being really into rock music and just looking at all the records and realizing, well, you know, if I want to participate in the rock scene, I could be a groupie. But then she saw the Sex Pistols, and it was the Sex Pistols and Steve Dave's that made her realize, no, wait a minute, I can do this. Mm-hmm. So yes, women are very much represented in the course. I think that when you look at an artist like Yoko Ono and what she was doing in the late 60s, this is very influential on a lot of what comes later. Certainly in the British punk scene, there's a lot of women. There's the whole Riot Girl movement. I think when you start to look for people of color, that's where it gets a little more problematic. Mm-hmm. But certainly, you know, when you're looking at American hardcore, the penultimate American hardcore band is the Bad Brains.
Right, like right. You know. Yeah, I did read up a little bit on that, hearing about there was before even I think the Bad Brains, there was a group called Pure Hell out of Philadelphia, a black punk rock band.
That's correct.
And so it opened my eyes because I guess my stereotype is always is no offense to you all. It's just a bunch of white guys out there doing their thing. But there have been other groups of folks involved. And is that something that you touch upon in your course?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I make a strong argument that the, you know, one of, if not the first real punk rock song is a song called Dimolé by a band from Peru called Los Psychos, which comes out in 1964. And it's about destroying the train station. But you need to take it back before that. You know, you've got screaming Jay Hawkins. You've got, you know, James Brown. I mean, come on, that's punk energy, you know. So it's just once it gets labeled punk, you know, it's when kind of like the rock scene is dominated by white guys, I guess. But there is a really great movie called Afropunk that kind of explores this exact topic, you know, black people in the punk rock scene and what their experience has been like.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get started teaching punk rock history at IU? It seems like a very fascinating class.
Yeah, so a good friend of mine, Glenn Gass, who started the history of rock and roll class at the Jacobs School of Music at IU, he called me up and he said, I'd like you to teach a class, you know, and so I had a meeting with him and, you know, we agreed, well, the one thing that I could teach, you know, I thought at the time, well, I could do this pretty easily, was punk rock. And what I didn't realize was that, you know, there were a lot of holes in my knowledge. You know, I was a fan, but I'm not really a historian, so I had to really educate myself. So then I just went and presented the class to the powers that be and jumped through all the hoops, and they gave me a slot, and it's turned into a quite popular class.
So it's been a popular class. What's the reaction from students that are signing up for this?
Well, it's interesting because I didn't really think about this, but you know, these kids are so young in comparison to me. You know, I thought, well, okay, punk rock, it'll be easier than the history of rock music because they'll know a lot of this stuff. But I'm dealing with young people who, if I'm lucky, their parents listen to The Clash. Mm-hmm. If I'm lucky, they have an older brother who's heard Blink 182.
Right.
So they don't know a lot about the music. And as I explained to them at the beginning, if you're to Black Flag, this might be, there might be a high price of it. Admission here, because you're going to have to listen to and identify 300 songs over the course of this class. And you know, my hope is that if it sounds like noise to you at first, you know, you give it a chance. And what I have found is that people, they fall in love with some of the wildest stuff that we play.
Mm-hmm. If you have any questions or comments for the show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Paul Mahern about punk rock history in the course that he's teaching at IU. I'm curious, what is the, I guess the students are coming to listen to this. Are they mostly music students, or is this just people who are interested in learning more about the history?
It's not mostly music students. So the class is given through the Music and General Studies program through the Jacobs School of Music at IU. And so the idea is to draw people from the other schools on campus to come study music appreciation. And so this is just one of many of these courses. I do get students who are serious classical musicians in the class, but I would say it's a small percentage. Mostly they're just music fans.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody walk away with a different understanding than what they came in with?
I think everybody does, including myself.
Mm-hmm. And what's changed your perception now that you've been teaching this? Is there anything that you learned along the way?
Well, I learned a lot about bands and that I didn't know that much about. And then I just fell in love with some stuff that I really didn't listen to that much. So, you know, my level of music appreciation has gone up. Just also what I've learned is 'cause there's a lot of discussion in the class. We talk about anarchy. Mm-hmm. Political systems. We talk about, you know, how the Detroit riots in 1967 kind of create this environment that the Stooges grow out of, and how 1974 New York is like a burned out city, and it creates this environment for the New York Dolls and the and the Ramones and how the same thing's going on in London. Everybody's on the dole, this trash strike, and it creates the Clash and the Sex Pistols. And so we talk a lot about how, you know, the environment seems to create this form of expression. And then just the kind of dialogue that's going on each semester, it's a different group of people. And depending on what's going on in the world politically, mm-hmm. those conversations can get pretty intense. And I have to be really upfront, you know, with the students, you know, warn them that we're gonna look at this film about Gigi Allen. You know, it's just like there's going to be a lot of trigger stuff. And then also just really trying to maintain a safe environment so that everybody knows that they can say whatever they want in that class, because ultimately that's what punk is to me. Everybody being able to express themselves, whether they're an anarchist or a conservative, whatever it is, you know, once you enter that class, it's a safe space.
And how much does Indiana music play a part in your class?
Well, I teach one lecture that is on Midwestern punk rock. And in that lecture, it's, you know, it's an hour and 75 minute lecture. Probably half of it is Indiana stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, that the gizmos, especially the original gizmos there, or all the gizmos are from Bloomington. I play a song at the beginning of that class called Muff Divin' in Wilkie South. Wilkie South is a dorm on the IU campus. And this song is basically an instructional guide to, you know, oral sex happening in the dorm at IU. And that really, I think that really brings it home for the kids on campus. But we talk about all the different versions of the gizmos. And I talk a lot about Dow Jones and the Industrials, and then talk about newer bands as mm-hmm. well.
And we'll be hearing from some of the members of some of those bands after a quick break. We'll be back with Paul Mahern and three other members of punk rock groups as we discuss the history of the genre in Indiana and how it has shaped the music scene in the Hoosier State. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam So. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. We're talking today about Indiana punk rock history with some of the musicians that lived it. We'd love your questions or comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us again is Paul Mahern, adjunct lecturer in Indiana University's Jacobs School of Music, as well as a producer, engineer, and lead singer of the Zero Boys. Dale Lawrence, former guitarist and vocalist for the Gizmos and current singer-songwriter for Indianapolis band The Vulgar Boatmen. Chris Clark, former bassist and vocalist for Dow Jones and the Industrials and current software engineer for Ball Aerospace in Boulder, Colorado. And Brad Garten, former keyboardist and vocalist for Dow Jones and the Industrials, current director of the Computer Music Center at Columbia University in New York. Before we get into more detailed questions, I wanted to go around and ask each of you how you even got into punk rock in the first place. What was that gateway to punk rock for you? This was all before the internet. So how did you find this genre? I'm sure it wasn't just a bunch of memes or something viral. So Dale, let's start with you. All right. I don't know if we can hear you. So let me ask Chris if you want to give us a little insight.
Yeah. So Greg Horn, our lead guitar player, Dow Jones, he's from Philadelphia. And according to his version, his parents forced him to go to Purdue University, where he was unhappy, and because his dad and his grandpa went there. But he was pretty plugged in. I went to his favorite music store in Philadelphia once. There was this radio station, KPIX, maybe. I don't know what it was. But they had all of the wacky bands. And so he was into Iggy Pop and the Sex Pistols and knew the Clash. And he had this great 45 of the Sex Pistols version of the song No Fun. Anyway, so that's how I kind of got introduced in the whole thing.
Okay.
Had a curator.
Yeah. And Brad, what about you?
Yeah, I was drawn in by, you know, Paul talked about the originality and experimentation that was part of the punk ethos. And that's how I came in, because I was really into electronic music and doing stuff with synthesizers and everything. And Greg Horn and I had formed kind of an experimental band called Accept the Bop, where we just did all kinds of weird things with long tape delays. And he started forming Dow Jones and kind of asked me to pretend to be like I was Brian Eno and sort of join the band as a keyboard player slash producer bizarreness. And yeah, that's how I got drawn in. It was fun.
And Paul, what about you?
Well, I was, and you know, when I was in eighth grade, I was very much into bands like Black Sabbath and Kiss. Just always been a big fan of rock music. And then at one point, I started getting into Cream magazine out of Detroit, and I saw the Sex Pistols on the cover of Cream magazine. And I just loved the way they seemed to be making fun of all the music that I liked. And that just really turned me on, like this whole concept of like no leaders, no followers, no heroes, you know, mm-hmm. destroy it. And that's when I was really hooked in, I think.
Cool. Thanks for sharing. And I don't know, is Dale with us?
I am here. I'm sorry. I'm here.
Okay. No worries. You know, it's just in the world of doing things online, sometimes I can't see everybody. So yeah. How did you get involved?
I was a student at IU and a music fan, and I knew all those East Coast bands. I loved television, but it was when I heard the Sex Pistols that it made the world seem like a different place, full of different possibilities. And for the first time in few years, I wanted to be in a band.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like to form the band The Gizmos from that? Was there some kind of influential push for that?
Yeah, I wanted to be in a band, but I didn't know anybody else that liked this music at IU. It was so foreign to what was going on there. And I ended up answering an ad by Culture Records saying they wanted to form a third band for their new wave roster or something like that. That's not exactly what they were doing. What they were doing was putting together a touring band for a member of the Gizmos, a Gizmos they could take on the road. I didn't know who the Gizmos were, but they took me on as a guitarist. And that lineup kind of morphed into the more streamed down quartet. So it was mm-hmm. haphazard. We were kind of like the Monkees. We answered ads.
and it worked, you know, you got your gig.
Yep.
Chris, how did the Dow Jones and the Industrials form in West Lafayette?
Well, I guess maybe for about a year, Greg and I just sat around and like listened to music and drank beer and pretended like we were in a band. And, you know, Greg was doing the thing with Brad. I remember seeing him out in this field at the Chauncey Square there, and it was at night and everything had dew on it, and they had actual physical tape loops and stuff they're playing. But anyway, so finally it's just I really wanted to be in a band, and you know, the punk seemed so cool because of kind of what Paul was saying. They made fun of the rest of the music, and not every, you know, we could be ultra snobbly, really super unique and cool, you know, and I really liked the music too. So I said, hey, my friend is a drummer. He lives in Huntington, and we drove up there like on the weekend, and we jammed in his bedroom, and we're like, yeah, we'll have a band. So that's kind of how we got started. He, Tim North was our drummer, and then he attended John Herron School of Art in Indianapolis. So when we practiced, he would come up from Indianapolis to Brad's house, and he's like a couple years younger than me. So I guess, yeah. So that for that first summer, you know, he was still just out of high school, and we came down and practiced together. And then we played a few gigs, just the three of us. And then Brad joined. I think the first time we played in a basement of a frat, that time when the first time that Brad played with us. And
I thought it was at a hotel we played
at. Now, remember hotel, Tim Marshall's frat? It was like this antiseptic.
There thing. You go. Sorry.
No, continue. Please do. Yeah, the hotel was the barn burner that the Gizmos attended. Yeah, so, and in fact, we played in Huntington at this place, the Pathfinder's home, and it was a home for people that were mentally disabled, and they had all levels of ability or disability. And we went in, Tim and Greg and I, and we had on all these weird clothes and sunglasses. We just like really super rocked it, man. It just like blew the doors off the place. We're in the gym and there was like a hellacious amount of dancing, and it was really quite a scene there. Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to hear the stories and the nostalgia. And we have a comment from Blake on Facebook who says, every Saturday night is punk rock night at the Melody Inn at 39th in Illinois. The punk scene is alive and well. Brad, what does that make you feel when you hear something like that?
I'm happy. You know, again, it's like Paul was saying through his class, though, it's really changed a lot, too, which is also part of the excitement of it. You know, the fact that it's this kind of this protean thing that's always kind of reinventing itself, you know. So I can imagine if I went there, I'd really enjoy the stuff, but I'd probably feel pretty old, too.
Well, when you look back at your music, Dow Jones and the Industrials was a pretty unique sound. When you look back at it to now, do you think it's changed? The scene has changed at all in the sounds that are coming out of it?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, a lot of the punk ethos has also kind of, at least in New York, collided with the improvisational scene there. And especially my entry into that is also through technology, because a lot of people are now experimenting with interactive electronics and fun stuff like that, you know. So I'd say, and again, we can't ignore the impact that the internet has had in terms of getting this music out there to like millions of people. Mm-hmm. I think it's healthy because it's very vibrant and it's also very diverse. There's no sense of kind of unification around a couple of bands like the Sex Pistols or Iggy and, you know, people like that. It's just, it's nicely all over the map.
Mm-hmm. And Paul, Zero Boys started after Gizmos and Dow Jones. Did these bands influence you anyway?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm here on the radio with my heroes right now. 100%. No joke. You know, the thing that was great about, or is great about punk rock is that, you know, these local scenes are really strong and you get to meet the people that are in the bands that you really like. I'd been going to a lot of big concerts in Indianapolis at the Convention Center and at Market Square Arena, but it wasn't until I saw Dow Jones at a little place called Third Base downtown that I really realized, wow, rock and roll can be even better in a tiny place than it is, you know, on a giant stage. And then you could talk to them afterwards. And that really sealed the whole deal for me and really wanting to pursue being in a band, but also be a part of the community of like-minded people who just like to have fun.
Mm-hmm. Have fun and perhaps rebel against the system a little.
Yeah. Yeah. And everybody has, you know, they do that in their own different ways. I would argue that Brad is still doing that in his life. He's managed to like create this existence that's quite unique. And I think that same way about myself. And it's like, it goes on and on and everybody has a different expression of how they're going to rebel and what they're going to create. And a big part of the punk ethos is the do-it-yourself attitude. It's not, you don't wait around for somebody else to do it for you. You don't send out demos to record companies. You just make it yourself. You press your own records. You create yourself as an electronic music professor, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like we've got a lot of our listeners thinking back on their memories of punk rock in Indiana. We got a comment from Jim on Facebook who says, I'm in San Francisco now, but I attended Purdue 1979 to 83 when Dow, Chris, and his crew were playing a lot of places. So I saw then often. They were great. The music was loud and obnoxiously different. Lyrics were hysterically funny. They had odd things going on stage, Kissy typing away in a business suit. Still, it was serious music. The sound they created was not like others. I especially liked the fact many fellow Purdueites would wind up at a show and just looked confused by it all. They definitely weren't doing covers of what the local radio was spinning out, but you could thrash crazily to it. Chris, how does that comment make you feel?
That makes me feel pretty good. The people that, so first of all, when we started, we had an instant entourage. Like everyone was there and they seemed to know their roles and they had all these really cool clothes and stuff. But then there was like this Purdue milieu and some of them would try to wear punk like clothes and they just couldn't disguise the nerdiness, you know, and the straightness, you know, the ag school, engineering school. And it was really great. And we even played at Harrison High School in the cafeteria once. And that was part of the early thing too. Was like, well, where can we play? You know, there's no clubs. There is no Melody Inn, and so we had to kind of improvise on just finding a place to play.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Chris, can you talk for a second? I hate to interrupt, but Chris, can you talk a little bit about your political career at Purdue?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about that for the last 4 years. And so, you know, my first thought was when Tim Brooke called me for the show, I thought, well, let's see, you have a guy, a joke presidential candidate who's running for office for some other reason, like in our case was to get free publicity for the Hoosier Hysteria album that we had with Dale and the Gizmos. And then this candidate unexpectedly wins after emphasizing how unqualified and what an outsider they are for the job. So does that seem to track with any other thing that has happened recently? And yeah. So I just thought, oh my God, it's not so funny anymore.
And, yeah, I never thought of that either. That's really terrible.
Marion, he was student body president. And Brad was almost homecoming queen.
Yeah, I demanded a recount, too.
You're so far ahead of the curve.
Well, I do want to get to Dale here. Dale, you're still involved in music. And what is it like when people find out the punk rock roots that you have and fans are discovering some of that other side of the stuff you do? I'm going to see if Dale is still with us. I know it's kind of tricky to.
Okay.
There you are.
It's great. And within the last 10 years, there's been a lot of younger people in their 20s that suddenly know about the Gizmos, which was before that. So that's always nice. And then some of them come and see the Vulgar Boatmen, and it kind of all ties in together.
Is it an odd experience to have younger fans discover the music and not really know what it was like actually to be part of that era where the music had a message for a particular time, or is it timeless?
It was really weird at first. We'd done reunion shows every few years, and we had almost thought we'd had to stop because the one show really wasn't very well attended on a New Year's Eve. And then we did another show just a year or so later, and it was packed, and it was mostly packed with people we didn't know who were like 21 years old. And the hardest thing to get it across to people is how uncool it seemed, because it was really lonely being the only punk rock band in Bloomington. We were so glad when we met Chris and Brad and Dow, because it's like, oh God, there's another band out there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, now it's so easy to connect with people. But back then, I'm just trying to remind folks who are listening, like there wasn't some viral internet that could just spread things. It was probably word of mouth and people attending events.
Yeah, exactly. And little handmade flyers. And mm-hmm. You just hope for the best.
Yeah. And Brad, what are some of your favorite memories of your time playing music in West Lafayette?
Oh, boy. I guess just how thrilling it was, you know. I mean, I'm always kind of like, you know, Paul has this great life as a recording. I pretended to be one for a while, and I always enjoyed just working in the studio, you know. But you know, to get out in front of like a huge crowd of people who are just screaming, that's pretty heady and powerful stuff, you know. And then, you know, when Chris ran for president and became president of Purdue University, then. Yeah, that was a pretty fun experience, I think.
Yeah, that was I kind of jumped in the middle of that. But that was an idea that somebody in our entourage had to promote this album with the Hoosier Hysteria album. Hey, we'll run Chris for student body president. You know, it wasn't really about me. And when it happened and I got elected, I mean, that really just kickstarted the whole thing. So that overcame the lack of Facebook and Instagram and stuff, because you know we were in the Star and then the Lafayette Papers and the Purdue Exponent in Bloomington, and so somehow that has really good synergy, you know, with the scene.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to get ready to wrap up, but I want to go around and give you guys each like 15 seconds to give us what punk rock means to you. I don't know if it's a word or a sentence. So I'm going to start with you, Paul.
A really, really loud Gibson guitar, Marshall stack combination. Just, I highly recommend that for stress relief, everybody get a Gibson guitar and a Marshall stack and just pound it out.
All right. Dale, what does punk rock mean to you?
Rock and roll. If it hadn't happened, I certainly wouldn't have had a life in music. And I don't know how rock and roll would have continued either.
Chris?
Really loud music. Uninhibited loud music.
All right. And Brad?
Back to what Paul said originally, and I started with originality and experimentation. There's just nothing like it.
Awesome. Well, thank you all so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time. Paul Maher, an adjunct lecturer in Indiana University's Jacobs School of Music, a engineer, producer, and lead singer of the Zero Boys. Dale Lawrence, former guitarist and vocalist for the Gizmos, current singer-songwriter for Indianapolis band The Vulgar Boatmen. Chris Clark, former bassist and vocalist for Dow Jones and the Industrials, and a current software engineer for Ball Aerospace in Boulder, Colorado. And Brad Garten, former keyboardist and vocalist for Dow Jones and the Industrials, and current director of the Computer Music Center at Columbia University in New York. Up next, we're going to get into the details of the CDC's new mask guidelines and what the effect of the sudden change may have on public health. I'm Miriam So. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. It seems like the Centers for Disease Control, or CDC, is constantly changing the guidelines for Americans when it comes to wearing or not wearing masks. We know that the science behind COVID-19 and the way it spreads is evolving, and that with it, guidelines will change. But with the recent news stating that those who are vaccinated don't have to wear a mask indoor or outdoor, could this create another wave of COVID-19 infections if everyone abandons their masks, thinking it's no big deal? There are some debates that this change came too soon, with companies jumping to update their policies. With us now to help us understand what these changes mean and how it impacts our health is Shandy Durth, Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at Indiana University. Thank you for joining us, Shandy.
Thank you for inviting me, Miriam.
I'm going to start with the big question. Are we playing a dangerous game with masks?
I think we are, and I don't think that was the intention. Last week when CDC came out with their new guidance, they said, hey, vaccinated people, we see that you vaccinated people are not spreading COVID. And so we think it's okay that you go ahead and take off those masks. And unfortunately, what the rest of the world heard was, we don't need masks any longer. It's over. And unfortunately, that's just not the case.
Right, right. And I think that announcement came as a shock to some in the healthcare industry and medical professions. What was your reaction?
I had the same reaction. Like, you know, I've lived this every day for 15 months, 24/7. So I understood what the CDC intention was, but unfortunately, the message was not correct. The communication was a fail on this one. Mm-hmm. Because again, the vaccination requirement around taking off the mask was just not the strong point that everyone heard.
Right, right. I mean, I remember when I saw the headlines, it was just like, no more masks, but you know, if you actually took the time to read the article, it gave more details. And Dr. Anthony Fauci today is saying people are confusing the new guidelines. I think he's trying to kind of do some damage control, but is it too late?
I think it's too late because unfortunately, as we've heard, you don't need the mask. Everyone was so quick to jump in that boat. It's going to be really hard to rescind that. We're already seeing other states take that back.
Mm-hmm. Well, have mask guidelines always been this precarious? Are we just seeing it play out in public via the CDC? Behind the scenes, was this always sort of an up and down?
We've been learning each day as we go through the pandemic. It's not something that we had hard science on in the beginning. And so that's why we've kind of evolved. And that's why the guidance has changed so often. It's not that people are necessarily changing their minds and flip-flopping back and forth. It's that the science, you know, we had to have the data. We had to look at the science coming in as time evolved. And also, it's really hard to get a public health message out there that the masses understand. Well, we need to improve that in public health in general. But I think we really highlighted that during COVID, that we need to learn how to speak to the public better.
Mm-hmm. Was the intention behind this as an incentive to get folks to get vaccinated? Like, okay, if you get the vaccine, now you can be like this group that doesn't have to wear masks anymore.
Right. It was definitely to incentivize people kind of like, hey, look, once you're vaccinated, you can go to the concerts, you can go to the crowds, you can go and see your family, you can travel, that sort of thing. But again, what everyone heard was that no, we don't need masks any longer.
Now, I'll tell you, I personally felt a little hesitant when I heard it. I didn't hear the no masks any longer for everyone. I started thinking, well, is there evidence now that vaccinated people can't carry the virus and spread it to others?
And there's not a lot of evidence around that, but we're definitely not seeing evidence that they can transmit it. And so we've got so many people vaccinated now. And when we're doing the case investigations and the contact tracing, we're not seeing a lot of evidence of vaccinated people transmitting the disease. So that's why we can move forward with removing the masks for the vaccinated people.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you explain to us a little bit about the science behind these types of decisions? How does the CDC determine what level of risk is safe? Because there is still risk involved, even if you're vaccinated.
There is a risk. These vaccines are not 100% effective, although we can say in the majority of cases, people who are vaccinated, you're a lot less likely to show symptoms. And basically, no one ends up in the hospital with COVID if they've already been vaccinated with COVID before they get COVID. And so it greatly improves your chances of surviving COVID and not having a severe case. And so that's one of the many things they look at when making some of these mask decisions. But also, we've seen so much pushback. They've been under a lot of pressure to really reevaluate how much longer we have to keep the masks going. And one thing that I'm not hearing enough about in the media is the fact that we still don't have a vaccine for the kids under 12.
Right.
And so we need to protect those kids as well. I'm vaccinated, but unfortunately, my 10-year-old is not. So I'm still not taking him inside restaurants, inside crowded places, because he needs the extra protection. So he is wearing his mask. I'm wearing my mask when I'm out with him so that he's not the lone person out there wearing his mask. Although I do feel safe. I'm vaccinated. I don't worry about COVID for myself the same way I don't worry about measles, mumps, or rubella because I've had that vaccine. I know it works. But we need to get other people in the community to jump in that bandwagon and take their vaccine.
You know, I think there's a lot of confusion when there are these mixed vaccination families where, you know, some people are vaccinated and some aren't. Is it safe for people who are vaccinated, let's say, to go out without a mask and then come home to their unvaccinated family members?
We haven't seen any evidence telling us that it's not because, again, we're not seeing very high case numbers among the vaccinated crowd. Mm-hmm. And so it leads us to believe that we're unlikely, we vaccinated people, to pick up COVID and give it to our family members who are not vaccinated.
Okay, so I can go back to the gym at some point.
I got to say, I'm venturing out a lot more myself and my husband is too. Now that we're both vaccinated, our 15-year-old got her first vaccine. I know she's itching to get out and be like a regular teenager again soon. But we're still very protective of the 10-year-old. So we're not going to be flying anytime soon, not until he's vaccinated, because we just don't want to take, you know, any additional risk that we don't have to take.
Right, right. I feel you. I'm in the same boat. If you have any questions or comments for the show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. So there have been arguments made that lifting the mask mandate or just the mask guidelines for vaccinated versus unvaccinated, along with businesses who are now easing up masks, that this is all moving too fast. And there's no way aside from the honor system to know who's vaccinated or not. So, I mean, I know earlier we talked about this, but I'm wondering from this perspective, is it a bad move that businesses are so quick to adapt to this?
It is concerning because we have not had high enough vaccination rates to ensure that their employees will be protected. I think that's part of the reason we're seeing some companies like CVS, Walgreens, they've come out and said, we are going to still require mask use. Because you don't have the big red V on your chest to show that you're vaccinated. We don't know right. who's vaccinated and who's not. And the honor system is kind of a hard one to follow. And you've got to think about all of these hospitality workers who have been kind of at the forefront of danger this last year with the pandemic. We need a little more time to get everyone vaccinated and to make sure that those hard to reach communities are vaccinated before it's kind of a free for all.
Mm-hmm. And I know it's still too soon to measure the effects of this announcement and these changes, but in your opinion, could we potentially see a surge with the variants and less masking? Like, could this create the perfect storm?
It is possible. One thing in our favor is the fact that we're going into summer and people just tend to spend more time outdoors, and being outdoors is great for ventilation and it really decreases the risk of COVID. So I would be much more stressed about this had this happened in, you know, say February or March. But I do think it's a concern. I think what we'll probably see is more cases among kids, you know, because if the parents are vaccinated and they're no longer wearing the masks, I can see the kids no longer wearing masks. So I could see a bump in some of these younger age groups that have much lower vaccination rates.
Right. And we touched on earlier the vaccination of 12 to 15 year olds. Now, how important is it for children to get vaccinated?
It's really important because, again, they're in such tight congregate settings on a regular basis because of school and school-based activities that we need them vaccinated as well. Here in Indiana, we've got about 360,000 kids in that 12 to 15 age range. At this point, since it was just released last week in the age range, we have about 6% of the people in that group who have already had their first vaccine. If we could get all 360,000 kids fully vaccinated, that would really help increase our chances to reach that herd immunity. We've got about a little more than 6 million people in the state, and we only have about 2.3 million fully vaccinated right now in the state. So we need every age group to do their part and get those vaccines. I've got, like I said, I got my daughter vaccinated last week. Super easy. A lot of clinics now, you don't even have to pre-register. You can just take them in and do it right then and there. Really fast, no wait. I recommend it to any parent.
I've been hearing from a lot of folks that are like, okay, that's great, 12 to 15, but I have like an 11 and a half year old and I want to get them vaccinated. How soon do you think the younger ages will be getting approval for the vaccines?
So those studies are happening now. We're hoping in the fall they will be approved the next age group. So I'm guessing, you know, October, we might hear something. That's what we're kind of counting on. I hope it doesn't go much later than that, but we will be back in the next school session before those younger kids can get vaccinated. So it's another good reason to go ahead and keep up mask use whenever your kiddo is around other unvaccinated families over the summer.
Mm-hmm. You know, I am a little curious about, with the emergency authorization for the 12 to 15 year olds, do you think that prompted the CDC to lift the masking guidelines? Or, you know, I'm just curious also, like, why they didn't wait until that age group could have been fully vaccinated, like 6 weeks from now?
I mean, that's a great question. I would think just as we're getting into summer and we saw a lot of people kind of have issues with wearing a mask last summer, you know, outdoors, it's warmer. People are a little bit crankier with the mask use, unfortunately. I think that was part of the push, but also our numbers have gone down dramatically, which is great. I know here in Indiana, we still require mask use through the schools. Most schools will be out after that first week in June. So I would imagine we'll keep up the mask use through the end of the school year. So I think that's part of the reason they're looking at lessening the mask use in, say, June, July, August.
Mm-hmm. And how is Indiana shaping up so far? I know more folks are getting vaccinated. Some of the numbers seem to be doing better. Does it look like heading into summer, things will be pretty good?
It's definitely slowed down, unfortunately, at the vaccine clinics. And so now what I'm hearing is public health officials are looking at what point do you move away from those mass vaccination clinics and move it more towards the doctor's offices and the big employers. I know I live not far from one of those big distribution centers, and I noticed that they had a vaccine clinic the other day for their staff, which is great because I think we're getting to that point where a lot of people who are willing to go to a mass vaccination clinic have probably already gone, and we probably need to start getting the vaccine to them instead of expecting them to come to us. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll see that evolve over the summer, which can hopefully increase our vaccination numbers because, unfortunately, Indiana is behind in many other states on vaccines at this point.
And is there a chance that we'll be needing boosters at the end of the year?
I think eventually what is probably going to happen is COVID will become a regular vaccine like what we see with flu vaccines. So we imagine that this one dose of COVID vaccine that we got this year is not going to be the end all be all. It will probably become a regular occurrence that we deal with for the rest of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of concern now about the variants that are circulating in the U.S. And I recently read something that pointed out until other countries around the world are under control, the pandemic in the U.S. will never be over. And that's a sobering thought because even though more people are getting the vaccine than I guess when the vaccine first came out, it doesn't mean it's over. So what is the solution to get everyone on the same page?
Right. And so that's where the U.S. really does have a vested interest in helping other countries get the vaccine, get the supplies needed, because the longer COVID is transmitted around the world, the more opportunities it has to create these variants, which could then come back on us here in the U.S. So it is possible that we could have everyone vaccinated and then some of these variants sneak in and the vaccines that we have aren't strong against the variant. So far, we've been lucky, but we can't promise that's going to happen going forward. So we need to vaccinate just not just ourselves, but again, help the rest of the world, because again, protecting them will eventually help protect us as well.
Mm-hmm. And well, what has the U.S. done right so far when it comes to battling this pandemic?
So I like all of the PR that I'm starting to see around vaccine and the fact that it's up to us. I like some of the PSAs talking about some of the sporting events and concerts, things like that, that if we fans want to get back to normal, we need to do our part and take the vaccine. You know, we're very privileged in this country that we got the vaccine that we have such easy access. Other countries, I think Germany just released the vaccine eligibility down to 65 recently. So a lot of other countries are where we were 3-4 months ago when we were all fighting to get to the vaccine. So we need to take advantage of the privilege that we have here in the U.S. and use the resources that we have at hand. And remember that not everyone is so lucky.
Right, right. I mean, we've seen other countries that seem to be under control, and then now they're just falling apart, the health systems. Is that something that could happen in the U.S. or because of the privilege of what we have so far with the vaccines and stuff, could that be avoided?
If you're talking about another big hit on the healthcare system, we don't expect that to happen with COVID at this point because we've had a lot of lessons learned, but there's no guarantee that this is the last pandemic that we'll see in our lives as well. So it's another reason to really take this time as we move past COVID to look at the public health infrastructure, look at what we need to plan for next, because we can't just walk away from this and act as if it's over, because we need to prepare for next time. I think the pandemic really highlighted a lot of gaps that we have in our healthcare system and our public health system, and we need to be better prepared for next time. We could have done better than we did, and I hope we do better next time.
Right. And I was going to ask you, you know, if you look back to 6 months from now or even a year, what are some of the lessons that we learned?
Oh, many, many lessons. One, again, just the communication, how public health officials communicate with the general public. The whole idea of how we can collectively purchase and buy PPE, personal protective equipment. That was a big sticking point, you know, early on when the strategic national stockpile didn't have the reserves that public health officials had been promised for years. And so I think everyone's going to have a plan B, C, and D in their back pocket for the next pandemic, assuming that some of these big federal projects that we had planned on might not be in place next time going forward. And hopefully more cooperation between jurisdictions, between states on securing equipment, staffing, training our public health workforce. We have a lot of public health people set to retire in the next few years, and we need to build that public health workforce going forward.
Mm-hmm. And maybe possibly pushing that as an area of study and for folks to look into.
Yes, President Biden's actions last week when he came up with the proposal for additional public health funding, he actually talked about strengthening the public health workforce and also creating a mechanism so we can quickly gear up and increase staffing in time of outbreaks. So hopefully we can get a better mechanism in place for that going forward.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Shandy, for sharing your expertise with us and letting us know where things stand and how to stay safe, keep those masks on. Shandy Dirth, Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at Indiana University. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like to listen to this show or any past show, find it anywhere you get your podcasts and join us tomorrow when we explore the changes in Indiana foster care. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.